Okay, good afternoon. I'll call the March 21st meeting of the Ag Finance and Policy Committee to order. This remote meeting will be held in accordance with House Rule 10.01. Roll call, Mr. Smith.
Here, Sundin.
Here.
Sundin present. Representative Vang.
Present.
Representative Anderson.
I think, Mr. Smith, you're on mute. I can barely hear you, but Anderson is present, yeah.
Representative Anderson. Thank you. Representative Buerkle.
Buerkle present.
Representative Eklund.
Present.
Representative Hanson-R.
Hanson-R present.
Representative Hanson-Good.
Present.
Present. Representative Cleveland. Representative Lippert.
Lippert present.
Representative Lewitt.
Lewitt present.
Representative Miller.
Miller present.
Nelson present.
Representative Thompson.
Thompson present.
You have the call, Mr. Cook.
Okay, thank you. We have the minutes of the meeting of March 16th. Representative Thompson, can I get a motion from you?
So moved, Chair.
Okay, Thompson moves the adoption of the minutes of the meeting of March 16th. 2022. Any questions or concerns? Seeing none, hearing none, all those in favor of approval signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say nay. Thank you. That motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. We have a couple of bills up today, but first we'd like to hear from the Department of Ag on how the agri funds are being spent. Just quickly, members, the legislature provides the Department of Ag over $16 million a year for grants provided through the Agriculture Growth Research and Innovation Program. While some of it is targeted, the benefit of the program is that it provides the department with flexibility to respond to emerging issues and changing demand. They do an excellent job providing an annual report, but since it does involve significant funding, I did want to provide the committee with the opportunity to hear about how the funds have been used in fiscal year 21. We have about 20 minutes blocked for this, including time for questions. Ms. Bress, I think you're first up. Please state your name for the record and begin the presentation.
Hello, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ashley Bress. I supervise our grants team within the Ag Marketing and Development Division of the Department of Agriculture. I'll be joined later today by my colleagues Paula Huguenin and Emily Mayer. Nancy, could we please get the slides up on the screen? Excellent. Thank you so much. And if we could go on to that next slide, that would be fantastic. Excellent. You members of the committee should have three documents included in the meeting material today. The first one is one that you are used to seeing year after year. That's our annual legislative report. That documents our grant making over the prior year. So our last report goes over fiscal year 21. It was submitted February 1st. And that report does a great job of outlining the investments that we were able to make. Members, you'll be most interested probably in the appendix, which is going to include brief overviews and the names and locations of our recipients, usually sorted by legislative district, as well as maps showing their locations throughout the state. You should also have a copy of a third-party evaluation that we performed around this time last year. And my colleague Paul will be going through that in a little bit more detail. And then finally, there's a two-page status update on where we're at with fiscal year 22 grant making. That document was just added in the last half an hour or so. So be on the lookout for that one. And if we could go on to the next slide, that would be great. Excellent. Many of you will remember that last year there were several changes made to the agri budget rider compared to what we would do in other years. Last year, for the first time, you set aside $750,000 specifically for livestock processing grants. There was also $3 million allocated for biofuels in infrastructure. We did recently, or we had that RFP open earlier this year. It just closed on Thursday, as a matter of fact. The response to that program was overwhelming. We received 71 applications requesting $10.6 million. That is still a very preliminary number because the application did just close on Thursday. So we're just now really getting the opportunity to dive into those applications. You also set aside $1.4 million per year for our livestock investment grant. We've been doing this grant program for many years. It predates Agri, but this was the first time that a specific dollar amount was set aside for livestock in investment grants. The amount that was allocated for our incentive payments also increased from $2.5 million to $4.5 million per year. And I can report that through the end of the second quarter, we have already spent the entire $4.5 million for this year. And then finally, the amounts for Farm to School, Urban Ag, and Good Food Access were all increased as well. And my colleague Emily will be able to talk a little bit more about Farm to School and Urban Ag. Next slide, please. All right. As I've already alluded, we are well into our grant making for this fiscal year. We've awarded the vast majority of our grants, but we still have three programs that are currently under review. As I mentioned, that it's going to include the biofuels infrastructure that had an overwhelming response, as well as Good Food Access, both the equipment and physical improvement grant, as well as technical assistance. All three of those closed on Thursday, so we have a good amount of work in front of us to get those reviewed. And then we also have our value added grant that's going to be closing this Thursday at 4 o'clock. If you have constituents in your district who may be interested in this grant, this is, we're down to the final few moments to make sure that everybody is aware of it. And then we'll be doing our second round of livestock investment for this year. We'll close on April 5th at 4 o'clock. And then we have a little bit longer to go on GAP and New Markets Cost Share programs. Next slide, please. All right. As I've already mentioned, our livestock investment, our livestock processing grants are new this year. For many of you, you might think about this as an offshoot of our standard value added grant program that we've been doing for almost a decade at this point. But this was the first time where we were able to release an RFP that was specifically tailored towards these types of processors. As you can imagine, the response to this program was overwhelming. We received 67 applications requesting $3.2 million. So we were only able to award grants to about 15 grantees worth about $709,000. So again, a very competitive program, which means we did unfortunately have to turn a good number of folks down, but their applications are going to automatically be considered for our value added grant that closes on Thursday. But those applications we funded were really, really strong, as you can imagine. We were able to fund a couple of the processors down in St. Paul or in South St. Paul. I think we had four in there at least from BIPOC producers, as well as some of those more traditional Main Street butcher shops that you may be thinking about. At this point, Mr. Chair, with your commission or with your permission, I would like to turn it over to my colleague, Emily Mayer.
That would be terrific. Emily Mayer, would you please identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Emily Mayer and I manage grant programs at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Today, I will be sharing a bit more about our Farm to School grants and our Urban Agriculture grants. The Farm to School grant program's goal is to help schools purchase and serve more Minnesota grown and raised products in their school meal programs. In fiscal year 21 and fiscal year 22, we offered two grant options. The first bite intended for schools who were new to farm to school, and the full tray option, which was intended for schools with prior farm to school experience who are looking to either expand their local procurement offerings or continue to build relationships with Minnesota farmers and producers. In fiscal year 22, we also offered an additional option for applicants to request funds to purchase equipment to support their farm to school efforts. This was in addition to their food request. This additional request was open to both First Bite and Full Tray applicants. This year in fiscal year 22, we awarded just over $741,000 to 46 schools and districts throughout the state. We received 68 applications requesting close to $1.3 million. So we were able to fund approximately 68% of the applications that were received. Next slide, please. Our Agri-Urban Ag Grant Program was established in 2018 with the goal of encouraging urban youth agricultural education and urban agriculture community development within city limits of urban or peri-urban areas. This grant prioritizes projects that demonstrate a commitment to either positive environmental impact, economic justice, and projects that are located in or serve BIPOC communities. In fiscal year 21, we awarded $551,000 to 14 grantees throughout the state. In total, we received 53 applications requesting $2.3 million. So like our other Agri grants, this was a very competitive round of funding. We are still in the process of finalizing, back to that previous slide, please. We are still in the process of finalizing contracts with our fiscal year 22 grantees, but I just wanted to share a bit about a couple of our fiscal year 21 grants that focus on our priority populations and focus on urban agriculture, youth, and community development. So one of those projects is the North Country Food Alliance. They're located in South Minneapolis, and they receive funds to work with the Somali American Farmers Association to expand and update the community garden that is located at the Horn Towers. This project includes funding for two food fellows and cultural interpreters to increase accessibility to the garden for the residents who live there. And another fiscal year 21 project was Growing North, which is located in North Minneapolis. They receive funds to hire youth workers to work at 21 community garden sites throughout the North Minneapolis neighborhood. Their project focused on teaching ag-based entrepreneurial skills through hands-on growing experience with farmers and mentors from the community. With your permission, Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn the presentation over to Mr. Huguenin.
Mr. Huguenin, welcome back to the committee. Please go ahead and offer your input.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Paul Huguenin. I'm the Director of the Ag Marketing and Development Division. You know, one of the last committee meetings that this group had before COVID, Representatives Miller and Representative Hansen R. came to an agreement, which was kind of fun to see, but they agreed that they wanted to see us conduct more program evaluation related to Agri. So what we did is we hired an outside evaluation firm, and we focused on a five-year period, and we asked that company to reach out and conduct surveys with participants in our program. They did a combination of online surveys as well as more in-depth interviews with folks to get at what their perceptions and what their experiences were like and what impacts our programs have had. They also reached out and did in-depth interviews with stakeholder groups, so farm organizations like Minnesota Farm Bureau and Farmers Union, commodity groups, Agulization Research Institute, and others. Next slide, please. And while the full results are in part of your meeting notes, and I encourage you to take a closer look at that when you have an opportunity, it's long. It's like 80 some pages with a ton of detail. But I wanted to call out a couple of key points. Approximately 90% of the participants in Agri reported increasing their gross revenue. And over 40% of the people reported increasing the number of employees, the number of jobs that they were hiring. A little bit of context about the jobs number. If you look at kind of the differences between, say, a typical deed grant program and what we do with Agri, With DEED, they tend to be looking for bigger projects, new investments, large campus factories in communities. Whereas with Agri, we're often focused on smaller farmers, smaller meat processors, people that we're trying to help gear up to transition, gear up to become more profitable so that those businesses in Main Street can be successful for another generation. Jobs are certainly important, but with Agri, we also have another, there's more to the story than that. Next slide, please. So this presentation so far, as well as the legislative report, the third party evaluation, very, very data heavy. And so I wanted to take just the last minute of our remarks to focus on the human side of Agri. And I really do hope at some point that you'll all be able to get a chance to meet our staff in person. We would welcome that. It's a group we're very proud of. They bring a variety of skills and backgrounds, several people with ag backgrounds, others with strong backgrounds in grant making. We just hired somebody from DEED, for example. We've got folks with ties to the dairy community. What they all have in common is that they all emphasize providing customer service to farmers and to processors. You saw the numbers, and so you know that there's a lot of folks who aren't able to get funding, particularly in their first go round. And so our staff focus on being able to provide constructive feedback and encouraging people to come back and try again if their first application wasn't successful. Next slide, please. Some of you might recognize our newest hire in the lower right-hand corner. Dacia Hinkhouse is replacing a recent retiree we had. But you may recognize her because she spent a lot of time working for the House of Representatives. And so I just wanted to let you know that one of our new Agri staff actually has ties back to your institution. Next slide, please. The quality of the staff came through loud and clear in our survey results. 90% of the folks said that they felt that it was very easy or easy to apply for our programs, which is not a small, it's not an easy task when you consider that because we're stewards of public money, among other things, there's something like 13 policies that the Office of Grants Management has created that we need to comply with, as well as just in general, making sure that as a state agency that we are handling things the way that we need to for public money. And that means it can be cumbersome, but our staff work really hard to help farmers and processors navigate the system. I think that last quote from Jason Fisher really kind of gets at the human side of the people that we serve. So much of what we're doing is helping farm families transition to the next generation, helping to hopefully create a profitable path for them. And that's a big part of what motivates our staff. And we thank you very much for the opportunity to do that. Next slide, please. With that, I want to thank you very much for the opportunity to give a quick update and invite you to read those documents with much more detail. We would be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Hugan, and it's always good to hear from you. Do we have any questions or comments to follow up with the presenters? Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Hugan, and thank you for the evaluation. I think we need to do this on third-party evaluation on more of our projects to see if they're working. I did see the quote from the Conger Meat Market, and just wondering if you could highlight, is that for the goat market? So that provides some support for the Somali community.
Mr. Dugan?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, I am not 100% familiar with Conger Meat Market's project. Perhaps Ashley knows more about that. I'm not sure if that, I know we have a number of grantees who have utilized a value-added grant and the meat processing grant to serve Somali communities and to do halal processing. I'm just not positive if Jeremy is one of those.
Chair Hansen, anything further?
If you can follow up later, that's fine. No problem.
We would absolutely do that.
Any other questions or comments from the committee? Representative Miller, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief since my name was uttered along with Representative Hansen. What he clarified, I also agree with. I think that follow-up is important. And I do appreciate the follow-up that you guys did in-house, but I do think that a third-party assessment would be an important thing. Not just, by the way, not just on this program. I just think the government needs to do that more, follow up and see what we're spending our money on and seeing how it's doing its job. Thank you.
Yeah, I would thank the testifiers, and I'd encourage the committee to follow up with them if you have any further questions. Your hand is down. No, okay. We have a bill up. Our Representative Lippert. Chair Pinto has asked this bill be referred to the Early Childhood Committee. Representative Lippert, would you like to move that House File 4120 be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Early Childhood Finance and Policy Committee?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Okay, that's House File 4120. That's, you've heard the motion and the intent to move it on. 4120 is before us. We have about 20 minutes for this bill. Representative Lippert, tell us about the bill. Let's hear the testimony. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we heard about farm-to-school grants, some in the agriculture presentation. This bill increases the amount of funding for the Minnesota Department of Agriculture farm-to-school grants from $800,000 to $1.6 million. We just heard that demand for the grants far exceeds that $800,000 amount. The bill also expands eligibility to early child care providers or early care providers, making fresh local food available to our youngest children as well. At this point, I'll turn it over to the testifiers who are with me today.
Okay, I see first up is Jamie Rockola. Please.
Hello, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
And members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jamie Rockola, and I'm the Child Nutrition Services Manager for Tri-Valley Head Start and Child and Family Programs. Tri-Valley is a community action agency headquartered in Crookston, Minnesota, with Head Start, Early Head Start, and Migrant and Seasonal Head Start programs located in 15 locations throughout the state of Minnesota. So we're located up in East Grand Forks in northern Minnesota, all the way down to areas like Elgin, Winnebago, Sleepy Eye in the southern Minnesota region. Tri-Valley serves over 1,000 families and children ages 0 to 5. Tri-Valley has been incorporating farm to early care into classrooms and family engagement activities since 2016. The Child Nutrition Services Department uses a curriculum that was created by myself with the help of my coworkers. And the purpose of this curriculum was to implement a curriculum structured for children in the migrant and seasonal Head Start settings and incorporate farm to early care objectives that would allow for the procurement of local foods, which would be incorporated into the menus, customize the curriculum to work with Minnesota growing season, and would also coincide with Head Start performance standards. Speaking nationally on farm to early care, I found that there was many great curriculums to incorporate into programs, but the barrier was that the program funds are unable to support the cost of these curriculums. So early care settings have a really hard time purchasing educational materials to help enhance and implement farm to early care within their early care programs. I currently serve on the Minnesota Farm to Early Care Advisory Group, and there was a tremendous response to the Farm to Early Care mini grant program that we piloted, which was supported through the Association of State Public Health Nutritionist grant. I reviewed multiple applications from early cares throughout the state of Minnesota, and the interest and ideas revolving around farm to early care initiatives really blew me away. The large applicant pool solidified the huge interest in local purchasing from the early care sector. It would be a substantial benefit for all early care programs if we had a more sustainable funding source, as the pilot grant was something that was not an ongoing grant. A little background, according to the CDC, childhood obesity affects 1 in 4 children between the ages of 2 and 5, with approximately 60% of those children being in a non-parental care arrangement. And so early care education settings are one of the best places to reach young children with obesity prevention efforts. My goal as a child nutrition professional has been to advocate for these children and families by improving the early care and education environment. Food insecurity and food access, especially in rural Minnesota, is an issue and a key contributor to unhealthy lifestyles seen in children and families. Nutrition education and early introduction of healthy foods at an early age plays a really key role in prevention of childhood obesity. We have noticed a positive effect on families and children that we serve by incorporating farm to early care initiatives within our program. In fact, we have been seeing an improvement in heightened weights and a decrease in BMI at the children that Tri-Valley serves in our Region 5 Head Start centers. In 2018-2019, 31% of our children in our Region 5 program were considered overweight or obese. At the end of the season, there was a 26% improvement. In 2020-21, 44% of children were considered overweight or obese, and there was a 38% improvement. And this year, we are seeing a 22% of the children are overweight or obese. And I believe the results have decreased because of the implementation of fresh produce and the nutrition education that we're able to implement within our classrooms and the education we've been able to give to our families. Pat Hillman, he is an owner of Heritage Angus Farms in Sauk Rapids. He's been Tri-Valley's beef supplier for 2 years. He stated in a letter of support to Tri-Valley that Tri-Valley has shown their commitment in farm to early care in Minnesota by developing a farm to early care curriculum, incorporating that into their classrooms, and procuring local foods for their monthly menus. We are a USDA beginning farmer, started in 2016 in central Minnesota, and the relationship we have built with Tri-Valley has been essential in getting our direct-to-consumer beef sales established. We just completed our second year of providing Head Start centers with fresh beef, and we look forward to maintaining this contract for many years to come. So just to give you an example, in 2020, we purchased 1,474 pounds of beef from Pat, and that came to $7,370. And in 2021, we actually increased the pounds of beef to 2,561 pounds, and that was $12,807. So along with sourcing local beef, our centers try to purchase as much local produce as possible. The Crookston Family Service Center Head Start purchases celery, carrots, cabbage, raspberries, just to name a few from Nana's Farm, a locally family-owned farm of Crookston, Minnesota, located in the fertile Red River Valley. As much as I would love to support local growers and fully source all of our produce from local growers in all of our programs, sometimes the lack of funding and the budget does not allow the purchasing of fresh fruits and vegetables, and we have to purchase frozen because of the cost. So support of this bill would allow additional funding to help make access to fresh fruits and vegetables more affordable for early care settings. I believe early care facilities can directly influence what children consume, which helps develop a foundation for healthy habits for life. Farm to early care initiatives connect young children with healthy locally grown foods and support farmers in the community. I encourage you all to support this very important bill and help make a positive impact on children's life. I thank you for your time today on this bill.
Okay, thank you. Next up, we have John Peterson.
Yes, good afternoon, and thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm John Peterson from my family's farm, Ferndale Market. So I am here on behalf of my family's third generation turkey farm in Cannon Falls. We call ourselves Ferndale Market because we're named for my grandparents, Fern and Dale Peterson, who started our farm 80 years ago. I personally returned to the farm in 2008 to begin direct marketing my family's turkeys and to begin build upon our heritage growing turkeys outdoors and without the use of antibiotics. Today, we market over 30 different turkey products to retailers and food service accounts across the upper Midwest. And between our farm, our warehouse, and our on-farm retail store, we have a tremendous staff of about 25 people. And I'm very proud personally to carry on my family's farming tradition. I encourage you to support this farm to school bill because it's a program that has meant a great deal to my family's farm and, of course, to continued growth in local sourcing and opportunity for more Minnesota farmers and communities. In my family's case, we've been providing our turkey to Minnesota schools for about a dozen years. And last year, our turkey was served in approximately 20 school districts, ranging from the big metro districts like Minneapolis and St. Paul to outstate districts from Alexandria to Red Wing. These schools are typically purchasing our ground turkey or thigh meat or turkey hot dogs, all of which really help our utilization across the whole bird by balancing strong demand, typically strong demand for white breast meat, while providing a nutritious low-cost protein for these schools. Similarly, Farm to School provides our farm with year-round stability, which is a tremendous asset, as you might imagine, for a turkey farm. You might guess that many of our retail customers tend to forget about us until the Thanksgiving season rolls around, but schools really help to provide sustainable cash flow for us and consistent movement while diversifying our customer base beyond our typical grocers and restaurant customers. Lastly, I would just say I think some folks probably suspect that Farm to School is largely a feel-good type project, but trust me when I say there's real economic development happening here. In a typical school year, our farm will sell approximately 75,000 pounds of turkey to Minnesota schools, which my rough math would say should equate to approximately 500,000 meals. Every single one of those pounds passes not just through our farm, but through one of our processing partners in Marshall, Cannon Falls, Ellendale, or St. Paul. And every turkey that we grow, 8 to 1 pound of feed grown by area farmers and milled into our customer ration at a Minnesota feed mill. So each step of our farming, processing, and distribution reinvests and turns dollars in our local economy. So the dollars stay here rather than flowing to an out-of-state corporate office. In the world of ag today, few farmers have the satisfaction that we do seeing the fruits of their labor so tangibly. And I believe that Farm to School is the rare win-win-win. It's good ag policy, supporting independent Minnesota farmers and educating future consumers. It makes good school nutrition sense, and it multiplies dollars through our Minnesota economy. So I ask you to support this bill, and I thank you very much for the chance to share our Farm to School story.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Next up, we have Rachel Doherty. Please identify yourself and offer your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Sundin and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Rachel Doherty. I'm the Farm to School Coordinator for Mesabi East Schools. We are a small school district located in Aurora, Minnesota, which is in an hour north of Duluth. It is with this funding that Mesabi East Schools has been able to fully implement Farm to School programming. Mesabi East is able to incorporate a once a month Farm to School breakfast and or lunch and offer items with a seasonal vegetable bar in the fall. We offer taste testings of new food items and even a chili throwdown in which our culinary arts students develop a chili recipe that is paired against the school cafeteria for students to vote on. We would not be able to continue this program without this funding. This funding allows us to purchase beef and chicken from farmers in Hibbing, Minnesota, and produce along with other farmers in the Iron Range. It also allows us to purchase turkey from Ferndale Farms for Thanksgiving. We aim to have our student experience foods from all farmers willing to participate in Farm to School program. Currently, the school district has an average of 750 students that participate in Farm to School. This is through both educational programming and breakfast school to lunch programs. With the success that Mesabi East has had in implementing Farm to School, two additional East Range schools districts are beginning the Farm to School process next year. Additional schools participating in the program makes it more feasible to have farmers begin a relationship with the schools for growing foods. This supports farmers who want to improve production, therefore increase our local economy. In 2018, Mesabi East started Farm to School by purchasing from only two local farmers. We strive to make additional connections with local farmers, and we have just received requests for proposals from 8 local producers to include chicken, beef, wild rice, produce, and handmade noodles. To date, our current contracts with producers has resulted in over 7,000 pounds of produce, 410 pounds of ground beef, 240 pounds of wild rice from the Boys Fort Band of Chippewa, and 250 pounds of homemade noodles. Nana's Noodles, the handmade noodles, is operated by Claudia Selko, who started as a registered cottage food producer. She believed in Farm to School program at Mesabi East so much that she took the steps necessary to become licensed and now makes her product in a certified commercial kitchen, allowing us to purchase her product. Receiving the MDA funding from full trade grants Mesabi East Schools will increase sales to area producers by an additional $90,000. This school year, our district spent $9,000 of its own budget on local farm-to-school foods. This figure is in addition to what the district spends for my salary and the operation of the school district's greenhouses and student garden space. Over 40% of our school district student body qualifies for free and reduced lunch, which means next year it is even more important that our students have funding from the full tray experience to experience the taste of fresh garden carrot and the difference of farm-raised chicken in wild rice soup and other local recipes, especially since the USDA has decided not to continue funding for school meals. Finally, this funding can aid in providing our students with local healthy meals that they would not otherwise have access to. This is why I support this funding. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Next up, we have Peter Skold. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Sundin and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Peter Skold. I'm a vegetable farmer and land stewardship project member from Webster, Minnesota. My wife and I own and operate Waxwing Farm, a small mixed vegetable operation. We currently market our produce direct to consumers using the community-supported agriculture model, as well as through direct sales to restaurants and the Prior Lake Savage Area School District. It is in support of this last market that I'm here today. We've been selling to the Prior Lake Savage Area School District for just 2 years. After an initial trial run in 2020, we were able to significantly expand our offering to the district in the last year. We sold them more than 5,000 pounds of produce, and our gross receipts from them represented about 4% of our gross sales to that single district. We're currently in the process of preparing our request for proposals for the upcoming school year, and we're optimistic that we're going to be able to build on the relationship that we've developed with the district and continue expanding our sales for the 22-23 school year. Our success in selling to the district is due in large part to the existing farm-to-school funding. Direct marketing to any consumer requires a lot of work, but beyond actually growing the actual produce, we have to manage the relationship with the buyer, coordinate delivery logistics, and maintain whatever records and certifications are required by the district. On the buyer side, they too have to manage an additional relationship, make sure their staff are properly trained and the kitchen's properly equipped to handle our produce and do all the additional record keeping that might be required by the district. In our case, the current farm to school funding has lowered those barriers enough for us and the district to explore working together and learn how to make it work. Without that current funding, we would not have been able to surmount those barriers. In my opinion, expanding farm to school funding will mean that there will be more stories like mine throughout the state. Public schools purchasing from local farms that keep our tax dollars in the state, and particularly in the rural communities where those farms are located. Expanding funding means supporting jobs in school kitchens and on farms across the state. We have 5 seasonal employees, and when we're working with school districts, we're able to expand our sales into the off season away from the busy summer sales season, which means that we can keep people employed on our farm for a longer period of time in the winter months, which is ultimately better for our bottom line as well as our community and the schools. Furthermore, partnering with local farms, whether they produce vegetables, fruits, meats, grains, dairy, or more or anything else, gets more minimally processed foods into our schools. We all know that a healthy diet should be one that's low in processed foods, and as a parent of school-aged children myself, I'm deeply supportive of any policy that tips the scales in favor of more whole foods in our public schools. I hope you'll all consider supporting this bill and what it represents for our children, our schools, and our rural communities. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members.
Thank you, committee members. We have department staff on tap for any questions as well. So I'll open up the for questions to the testifiers, if anybody has a question. Okay, Chair Vang, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to thank Representative Lippert for bringing this bill forward. This is a great bill. I'm in full support of this. I just have a informative question, perhaps for MDA. If they keep track of how what types of farmers do these grants go to, whether it's how many are for dairy, produce, meat, for example?
Who would like to take that one? Okay, pick a testifier, Chair Vang.
I see Ashley Bress just turned on.
Ashley Bress, please.
Yes. Mr. Chair and Representative Vang, we are as a part of the application process, applicants are required to give us some data about who they anticipate buying from. And then we also have a specialty crop plot grant with the Institute for Ag and Trade Policy, who is working in collaboration with University of Minnesota Extension to do an evaluation of the farm to school program. And that evaluation will go into more depth about who schools are actually purchasing from. One thing to note is that within the evaluation process that we do for our grants, before selecting who the recipients are, we have a criteria in there that allows us to prioritize purchases from emerging farmers, including BIPOC producers. But there should be more data coming available from that partnership that we have with IETP and Extension.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Anderson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for maybe some of the department staff or the bill author. It sounded like from some of the testimony that the program worked well, and the farms that worked with the program kind of learned how to work with the bureaucracy or get the paperwork figured out, and the program worked well for them. So my question is, once a farm has worked with the program, gotten a grant, and learned how to kind of navigate the system, would they be eligible again a second or third time, or would this funding go to new recipients each year?
To the author.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Anderson, I believe that farmers are eligible for funds on a recurring basis, but I'll defer to Ms. Bress or Mr. Huguenin to confirm that.
Ms. Bress?
Mr. Chair and members, yes, right now the program is set up so that in a school's first year of participation in Farm to School, that they can apply for the first BITE grant, which doesn't have a matching requirement, has a lower barrier to entry, if you will, and they can only do that first BITE grant once. But then in subsequent years, they can apply for that first TRAE grant each year after year, so they can apply multiple times. In our case, we are actually awarding the grants to the schools to purchase from farmers rather than to the farmers to then be delivered to the schools.
Okay. Representative Anderson, please.
Thanks again, Mr. Chair. So it sounds like they can apply multiple times. And just a question maybe for you, Mr. Chair, or wondering, you know, this is a good program, and wondering when the budget targets are going to be coming out so that we can allocate the funds that our department is going to get. And just wondering if you've heard anything about that, or what's the future for the funding for the ag budget?
Well, thank you for the question. We will reveal that at our next meeting on Wednesday and start our decision-making after the committee's aware of all of that. So I'll have to report on that on Wednesday. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions for the testifiers? I would just comment here. The food, once it reaches the schools, are the students and the parents aware of the source of of that food? Are they aware of the programs and the people that are contributing feeding their children? To the author.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I think it's that schools are in different ways taking advantage of this educational opportunity to make sure that students are aware of where their food is coming from. And part of the excitement of the program is helping to build those relationships with local farmers and make those educational connections.
Great, glad to hear that. Okay, any further questions? Okay, hearing none, seeing none, you also have a number of letters that are submitted in support of the bill. Please check those out at your leisure. Any closing comments from Representative Lippert on the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we heard there's strong demand for this program for farm to school grants, and that this program is good for local farmers, local economies, and for healthy and nutritious food for our students. So I appreciate the time today and appreciate the consideration.
Okay, that Lippert motion to recommend House File 4120 be referred to the Committee on Early Childhood Finance and Policy Committee is before us. Mr. Smith, please take the roll on 4120.
Sundin.
Aye.
Sundin votes aye. Vice Chair Vang.
Aye.
Vang votes aye. Representative Anderson.
Anderson votes aye.
Anderson votes aye. Representative Burkle.
Burkle votes aye.
Burkle votes aye. Representative Eklund.
Eklund aye.
Eklund votes aye. Representative Hansen R.
Hansen R. Aye.
Hansen R. Aye. Representative Hansen J.
Hansen J. Aye.
Hansen J. votes aye. Representative Cleveland.
Cleveland votes aye.
Cleveland votes aye. Representative Lippert.
Lippert aye.
Lippert votes aye. Representative Lewick.
Lewick votes aye.
Lewick votes aye. Representative Miller.
Miller aye.
Lewick votes aye. Representative Nelson.
Nelson votes aye.
Nelson votes aye. Representative Thompson.
Anybody gonna tell me something like a robot? Thompson votes aye.
Thompson votes aye. 13 ayes and 0 nays, Mr. Chair.
Okay, the reading 13 ayes and 0 nays. This bill is on its way. Thank you. Our last bill up is Representative Anderson, 4166. We have the remainder of the committee for this bill. Representative Anderson, would you like to move that House File 4166 be laid over for future consideration?
That would be my move, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Okay. 4166 is before us. Tell us about your bill, and we'll hear from testifiers as well.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. House File 4166 is a fairly straightforward bill, as it adds a total of 6 words to a current statute contained in Section 346.155, Subdivision 7, that adds a second accreditation agency to organizations that can work with and possess what are known as regulated animals. You may ask what that would include. Quite simply, regulated animals are your large cats, bears, and primates, things like that, your larger animals that you see around in zoos and such. Currently in statute, there are 6 exemptions granted. This bill was done, by the way back in 2004. This bill was passed, current statute. There are 6 exemptions currently, and one of those is the American Zoo and Aquarium Association. The others exemptions include wildlife sanctuaries, some DNR situations or game farms, research and medical institutions. And the kind of a curious one here that have an exemption and would be allowed to work with regulated animals is a USDA licensed exhibitor of regulated animals while transporting or as part of a circus, a carnival, a rodeo, or a fair. And I'm bringing the bill on behalf of a very well-known zoo back in my district known as Hemker Zoo. And they are right now accredited by a second zoo accreditation agency, and that one is called the Zoological Association of America. That was formed sometime after the 2004 law was passed. They were not included in that exemption, and today we're asking that they also be included as an exemption to the statute in the 346, Section 155. Mr. Chair, I'm going to have a couple of testifiers. One is the owner of the zoo herself, and then somebody also from the ZAA who would like to talk about their accreditation organization and the Hemker Zoo itself. So, Mr. Chair, time now for testifiers.
OK, Hey, thank you. Is it Joan Hemker?
This is Joan Hemker. Thank you, Representative Anderson and Chair Sundin, for taking time to hear my testimony for the 4166 bill. This is a request to add the Zoological Association of America, ZAA, to Subdivision 7, Section 1 of the Minnesota Regulated Animal Statute 346.155. I am the owner of Hemker Park and Zoo, and we are accredited facility through the ZAA. Hemker Park and Zoo started in 1977 and has been accredited with ZAA since 2013. Since the Minnesota Statute 346.155 was set in place in 2005, Hemker Park and Zoo has had regulated animals. With our request to add the ZAA to the exemptions of the Minnesota statute, as it holds similar and in some areas stricter standards than the Association of Zoos and Aquariums, AZA. ZAA's stringent accreditation process exhibits an extremely high bar with respect to professional animal standards and focuses on staff, animal, and public safety. The accreditation program maintains a benchmark for standards of operations and surpasses the standards of state minimum requirements and federally mandated USDA APHIS Animal Welfare Act. According to AZA, an exemption from Minnesota 346.155 will exclude the ZAA, an alternative accrediting organization that is in place for over 17 years, is problematic from a legal perspective. The Equal Protection Clause of the United States Constitution requires state governmental bodies to treat an individual in the same manner as others in similar conditions and circumstances. On behalf of the ZAA, I thank you for taking the time to hear my testimony. Thank you, committee and chair committee members, for listening.
Okay, next up we have Tammy Theis. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Hi there, good afternoon. I'm Chair Sundin and committee members. For the record, my name is Tammy Theis, and I'm the executive director of the Wildcat Sanctuary here in Sandstone, Minnesota. We oppose House File 4166, which would exempt the ZAA. I was actually involved in the 2005 Minnesota Regulated Animal Bill, which was a response to escapes, injuries, and even one death by big cats here in Minnesota. That public safety bill had broad support, including the Department of Natural Resources, Minnesota Animal Control Association, the Minnesota Zoo, and Sheriff's Association, just to name a few. When that law went into place, local animal control authorities removed 33 lions and tigers from problematic menageries with a history of attacks and escapes. Since that bill was passed, we've seen a dramatic decrease in the number of big cats, bears, and primates in our state, and more importantly, the number of injuries. Exempting ZAA could cause an influx of the number of dangerous animals to increase in our state, as well as the breeding and selling of these species. We don't want to weaken a law that has worked for the past 17 years to keep our state safe. Law enforcement is neither trained or equipped to handle these types of incidences, and the bill would weaken current regulations. For example, a ZAA facility in Montana has been cited consistently by the USDA since 2004 of not meeting their requirements. And just in 2021, they were cited for unsafe housing where a wolf could escape, as well as the property containment fence was 3 feet shorter than the requirement. If this bill passes and the ZAA facility wanted to move to Minnesota, they would now be exempt and not even have to meet our state safety requirements. This is a risk to our first responders, who will be the ones to respond to public safety in an incident. And there are definitely ways that appropriate zoos that want to increase regulated dangerous animals can through the AZA mentor system. So we oppose HF4166, and I thank you for hearing my testimony today.
Thank you very much. I'd be looking forward to maybe a visit of your wildcat sanctuary.
Absolutely.
Yes. Next up, we have Christine Coughlin. Please identify yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Yes, thank you, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Christine Coughlin. I'm the Minnesota State Director with the Humane Society of the United States. We're a national animal protection organization working for the protection of all animals. We're not affiliated with local humane societies. However, we are the nation's largest provider of hands-on care for animals, over 100,000 animals each year. On behalf of our members and supporters in Minnesota, we thank you for the opportunity to share our concerns with House File 4166. This bill exempts entities accredited by the Zoological Association of America, or ZAA, from current law that restricts the possession of dangerous wild animals. This presents concerns because ZAA accredits facilities with histories of public safety and animal welfare violations. In 2005, Minnesota passed a law restricting possession of bears, big cats, and primates due to a series of public safety incidents. In this law, there is an existing exemption for facilities accredited by the Association of Zoos and Aquariums, or AZA. This is sensible because the AZA is a highly regarded and established zoo trade organization. For large and small facilities, accreditation by the AZA ensures that knowledgeable and experienced professionals provide care for animals in a safe environment at modern facilities. In contrast, at ZAA-accredited facilities around the country, people have been injured by captive wild animals, and facilities have been cited by authorities for unsafe handling of animals, inadequate public safety barriers, animal escapes, inadequate veterinary care, and other issues. Under House File 4166, ZAA-accredited facilities would no longer have to register regulated animals with local authorities. They would not have to alert local authorities if their big cats, bears, or primates escape or follow other state requirements. Exempting ZAA-accredited facilities from existing law threatens animal welfare, public safety, and adds burdens for our local law enforcement. And so we encourage you to oppose the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up, we have Tanya Smith, founder of the Turpentine Peak Wildlife Refuge. Please identify yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you so much. Good afternoon, Chair and committee members. My name is Tanya Smith. I'm president and founder of Turpentine Creek Wildlife Refuge in Eureka Springs, Arkansas. It's a sanctuary that currently cares for 87 big cats and 10 bear. Our facility is accredited by the Global Federation of Animal Sanctuaries, and I'm testifying today as a representative of the Big Cat Sanctuary Alliance, which we are current members of, and I currently serve as the Rescue Committee Chair. The Alliance stands in strong support of our Minnesota member sanctuary, the Wildcat Sanctuary. In opposing House File 4166, which would exempt the Zoological Association of America from current laws that restrict the possession of big cats, bears, and primates. I've been rescuing wild animals for 30 years. I know the industry that created the need for sanctuaries like ours to exist. I've come to recognize practices that raise red flags, and I'm concerned that I see those red flags in some current and former ZAA facilities. When Minnesota passed its current law, it wisely chose to only exempt exhibitors accredited by the Association of Zoos and Aquariums. AZA accreditation is the best plan for any facility that wants to acquire dangerous wild animals, especially apex predators like tigers. AZA membership programs provide help and support to any facility interested in working towards accreditation. Weakening Minnesota laws will add to the sanctuary community burden. Alliance sanctuaries are often on the receiving end of the problems that arise when substandard facilities overbreed or collect large number of animals, then pass them into the exotic animal trade, or they close up their shop. Please oppose HF 4166. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you. I understand we have two other witnesses. And remember, we are licensed to butcher names. So next up, we have a John Stajet.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dr. John Stajet. I am the executive director of the Zoological Association of America. ZAA is just 17 years old. We were not around when this bill was passed and was not given an opportunity. We didn't have an opportunity because we didn't exist to be able to participate in the discussion relating to this bill. AZA has been around a lot longer than us. I'm not here to debate between AZA and ZAA, but what I'm here to say is that we have a very stringent accreditation process. Our process is a 34-page application process that results in hundreds of pages of protocols and policies related to zoos and the governance of those zoos and the safety of those zoos. ZAA has the highest safety record in the animal industry. We are the second largest trade association in the zoological industry. And I would like you to know that a lot of our members, over 13 facilities, have dual accreditation with both ZAA and AZA. Facilities like Fort Worth Zoo, San Antonio Zoo, Pittsburgh Zoo, all these institutions are both members of ZAA and the AZA. Our accreditation is on par with AZA. If you put the two standards side by side, you would notice that everything that the AZA asks for, is ZAA also asked for it, and we collect that information. We have standards, we have engineering standards that surpass the USDA federal standards for enclosure standards, whereas the AZA is very subjective and they don't have standards. They have sufficient space requirements as opposed to us being able to say we want specific areas of requirements. In our policies and protocols for accreditation, we demand that our facilities have an acquisition and disposition policy, which we inspect on a regular basis. Meaning, we need to see your bird records, we need to see your breeding records, we need to see animal ID systems. We need to know where the animal come from and where the animal is going. We look at all those things. We are stringent about your collection plans. We are stringent about your vetting commercial sources for vendors, where you get your animals from, who's supplying animals, things like that. Anytime there is a black mark against the animal industry, animal escape, staff injury, these things not only affect that institution, but it affects the entire animal industry. And we don't want to see that because it affects the entire industry overall. And so ZAA is very stringent about where we go and how we do those inspections. Our inspection policy is a 3-day inspection. It's not just going in and rubber stamping. We take a close look at your program of veterinary care. We take a close look at your risk management. We have to have contingency plans. You must show proper risk management and mitigating those risks when it comes to big cats, large carnivores, and large primates. We have a no contact policy with class one carnivores and class one and two primates, meaning there is no petting, there is no public contact whatsoever. We're very, very strict about that. So ZAA has all these policies in place. And we are very strict, again, about safety. We pay very, very close attention to staff and public safety. All our facilities must produce a financial plan as to how they're going to run their facility. What's the perpetual use for it? Some of our facilities are privately owned, and therefore we require a policy to show what's going to happen to this institution and the animal collection after the death of the owner. We want to know exactly what's going to happen with the long term for these animals. So we pay very, very close attention to these kind of things. ZAA supports this bill, 4166, because it gives parity for AZA and ZAA. And it's really unfair to give one trade association parity over another one when we are all working on the same platform, on the same goals, for the same welfare and safety of animals. To give one institution footing over another when we are all competing in the same trade industry is really, really unfair. So I would ask the bill author, I would ask the chairman, I'm asking this committee to please grant ZAA the amendment to be included in 4166, because we are a legitimate organization, we are on par with AZA, and we have taken the necessary steps to protect the animals, to protect safety, to protect staff, and to protect the public when it comes to large animals, large dangerous animals, and carnivores in captivity.
Okay, thank you. Up next, we have Charlie Samet. Please identify yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Chairman Dean. My name is Charlie Samet. I am the legislative chairman of the Zoological Association of America, and I am also the director of a zoological facility in California, Monterey Zoological Society, an accredited facility. Thirdly, I am an inspector for the accreditation committee of the Zoological Association of America, and I want to reiterate what John just said. Our inspections of any facility take 3 days to go through and inspect and run those facilities through our standards is a strainer. It's not easy, and some don't make it, and some are tabled, and some have a lot of work to do before they receive our accreditation. But I do know, because I've studied it and I've seen it time and time again, that our accreditation standards are in fact on par and practically mirror those of AZA. And the reason they do that is because they're correct. They're what's necessary. And so when we were forming our accreditation standards, that's what we aimed for. And we weren't trying to be AZA. We were just recognizing that there's right and there's wrong, and we wanted our standards to be right. And that's why the two do mirror each other. In regards to this particular amendment to this law, this one baffles me a little bit, because you're already exempting organizations that have no standards, circuses, sanctuaries, that whether they belong to an accreditation program or not. The GFAS organization, their standards are nowhere near what AZA and ZAA standards are. So this exemption is by far a much, much safer exemption than those you're exempting already in the law. There was testimony today that I have to say I feel is a bit misinforming the chair and the committee, because when you talk about an escape in a zoo or an injury or a death to a keeper in a zoo, you have to be fair and say that that can happen in any zoo, not just a ZAA accredited facility. I live in a state where, here in California, where we had a major AZA zoo have a tiger escape and kill somebody in the middle of the night. It can happen in any zoo. To suggest that it's going to happen more often in a ZAA accredited zoo is misinformation, to say the least. This is a very, very deserving exemption that's being requested here. And I would ask that you fully support this. It's not gonna create more animals coming into your state. It's gonna create the ones that are there having the ability and a goal to meet a higher standard to become accredited. That's what this will do. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Mr. Samet. I appreciate the testimony from everyone today. Any questions or further discussion from the committee? Okay, hearing none, seeing none. Again, thanks for your comments. Any closing comments from the author before this bill is laid over?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I especially appreciated the testimony from Mr. Samet, saying that these two organizations test rigorously, and it shouldn't be a competition. It shouldn't be one or the other. And we already exempt a circus, a carnival, a rodeo, or a fair from some of these regulations. So certainly the ZAA, with its stringent requirements, should also be exempted. Is part of your packet, committee members, I know they're all electronic and sometimes we don't run those off, but we have produced a side-by-side. It is 7 pages long, the ZAA and AZA accreditation standards comparison. And I went through and I underlined, I got through about the first 4 pages and was just amazed at how similar and almost the same they both are. So for one to say we are better than you, you're not as good as we are, I don't think is fair. I think both organizations do a good job, and the ZAA should also be accredited and exempted under this statute. A couple things mentioned, that this would produce an influx of animals into Minnesota. I don't think so. Right now, there's only one zoo accredited by the ZAA. I wouldn't say that's going to be an influx of animals into Minnesota. And there was testimony, I believe, from Ms. Coughlin, the pretty dramatic testimony of incidents, and they are bad, that occurred at a ZAA facility. But we're also hearing that they can happen at other facilities as well. So I don't think it's fair to single out one organization for having a worse or poorer safety record than the other. So with that, Mr. Chair, I would renew my motion that the House File 4166 be held over for possible inclusion in the Ag Bill.
Okay, so be it. Thank you for the bill. House File 4166 is laid over. That concludes our agenda for today. This meeting is adjourned.